Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. We're going to start today, as we do many of our programs, and frankly have it as kind of a running theme throughout, as is true of many of our programs, with some insights into what the Chinese Communist Party is up to at the moment and their ominous implications for the country we love. Who better to speak to about these matters than Gordon G. Chang, our duty expert on China and one of the country's most prominent and I think most impactful analysts and commentators on what the Chinese communists and their friends are up to. And when I say their friends, I mean those here in the United States particularly. This is, by the way, the subject of a new book, which I've mentioned as a coming attraction. It's now available for pre-order at Barnes & Noble. It's entitled The Indictment, and there's a very nice blurb on its backside from Gordon G. Chang. We're pleased to have that, as always. He is, among other things, the author of a number of important books himself, including the classic The Coming Collapse of China. And there's more and more evidence by the day that that may, in fact, be in prospect in the near future. Gordon, it's good to have you, as always. And as always, let me thank you for all that you do. In particular, a very important piece we're going to talk about in the course of this segment and the next one at Gatestone Institute just today. Good to have you with us, sir.
Thank you so much, Frank.
I want to start, before we get to the Gatestone piece, just to get a little level setting with you, Gordon, about the visit between the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Kevin McCarthy, and the President of Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen, in Southern California at the Reagan Library last week, and what the Chinese Communist Party has been doing in the intervening period.
Beijing has these drills, which are basically practicing a blockade of Taiwan. They did this when Nancy Pelosi, then Speaker of the House, went to Taipei to meet President Tsai Ing-wen last August. And this time, the drills are about the same size, maybe a little bit bigger. You know, people say, well, these drills are in response to the McCarthy visit with Tsai Ing-wen. And yes, you could say that they were timed for that. But we know that China is always practicing to blockade or to invade Taiwan. And so really, this is just one in a series of very large scale Chinese military exercises near Taiwan.
Yeah, I think of it as a pretext for doing what they want to do anyway. And the key piece of this, Gordon, as you've explained here and elsewhere so well, is unfortunately, these are not just drills. These are the kinds of steps that you take to actually conduct those kinds of military operations, should they choose to do so. And blockading is one option, invading is another, attacking with all manner of weaponry. And the trouble is that it becomes harder and harder to discern how imminent one of those options may be to execution when they continue to sort of do them on such a regular basis, no?
Yes. You know, you had the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley. He's been constantly saying that war with Taiwan, China is not inevitable. Yeah, of course, nothing's inevitable. And he's also saying they're not imminent. And the problem with saying that they're not imminent is that there can always be an accident. Remember, in the last several days, we've had three militaries in close proximity to each other, China's, Taiwan's, and ours. And we know that China has engaged in some very dangerous intercepts of American and Australian aircraft over the last several months. And so I think that we need to look at this with a much more, we need to be much more mindful that we could be at war at any moment. And so, you know, we got this big establishment in Washington say, don't worry, we'll have lots of notice of war with China. Well, I think that that's absolutely wrong for a lot of reasons. And one of them is just the real possibility of accident, which is becoming greater and greater all the time.
Yeah. Well, and another reason, which you understand probably better than General Milley, is the Chinese make a art form of deception and trying to make sure that their adversaries are not aware of their true intent, or at least their willingness to act on their true intent. And Gordon, this is part of the thing that's so troubling about this, is that this is not the only thing Mark Milley is seemingly very wrong about. And this brings me to your article. He talks specifically in testimony recently before the Congress that basically there's nothing that we can do about China's future trajectory. It was defeatism of the first order, it seemed to me, as well as wrongheaded. It further disables, it would seem, you know, Americans to think about what can and needs to be done, which is, of course, the subject of our book, The Indictment.
Yeah. Milley said at the end of last month in testimony before Congress that China is on a rapid trajectory on its development of nuclear weapons, and that there's nothing the U.S. can do about it. Well, yeah, there's a lot the U.S. can do about it. One of them is that China is building these weapons with our money, with our trade and investment proceeds. So we cut off the flow of that money. China doesn't have the resources to build nukes. Right now, China is resource constrained. It's a big country, so they do have a lot of money. They have foreign exchange reserves and gold, but they have a local currency crisis right now. And basically, they build their money with local currency. We know they have the local currency problem because their economy is stumbling, and also because there have been a series of extraordinary protests over the last several months of municipalities not being able to provide benefits, promised benefits, or even salaries to civil servants. So there is this crisis in China that Milley should know about and that we should take advantage of.
Take advantage of, and more to the point, I think your basic recommendation in the GateStoneInstitute.org piece is do as Ronald Reagan did when confronting the last totalitarian communist regime bent on our destruction, namely the Soviets' Communist Party and the evil empire. And that was to cut off their cash flow. And it's harder because the Chinese have gone to such lengths subsequent to what they saw happen to the Soviets to entangle themselves with us and so on. But Gordon, you're of the view, as is our Committee on the Present Danger of China, that there's, as you say, a lot that can be done to try to constrain that. Talk a little bit about the IEPA provisions that might be used by the president, for example, in this regard.
Yeah, that's the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977. He also, the president has the authority under the Trading with the Enemy Act of 1917, which can be used in place of the 77 Act. And that gives the president broad powers. Now, for instance, President Trump used the 77 Act to ban TikTok and WeChat. Now, that was challenged in the courts, but it never came to a resolution because Biden reversed the ban. But there is wide power that the president has, and he can use that to redirect and get factories out of China, which is important for us. But also, there are other things that we can do. So, for instance, we have a free trade agreement with the Dominican Republic and Central America, DR-CAFTA, FTA, as it's known. We can just do a few tweaks. We can get our factories to move to Central America. That, of course, denies China a source of revenue, but it also makes our supply chains much more secure because we are shortening the distance between the point of manufacture and consumers. And by the way, for climate change people, you know, that actually is really good for the air.
Reducing the pollution. We're going to come back to this point. We'll be right back with Gordon Chang right after this. this is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Predictably, the Chinese Communist Party has responded to Speaker Kevin McCarthy's meeting last week with Taiwan's president by conducting increasingly aggressive military drills and other preparations for a shooting war. Even as that prospect continues to grow, American friends of China continue irresponsibly and recklessly to enable the CCP to inflict harm on us in the event of conflict. A prime example is Wall Street's ongoing practice of investing our pension plans, mutual funds, etc., in communist Chinese companies, even though in the event of a conflict, every dime would surely be lost. Then there's travesties like the governor of Michigan giving an explicitly CCP corporation called Goshen $700 million in subsidies to purchase and inevitably despoil pristine land in the state's heartland without any regard for the national security risks. We need a war footing, not more of such suicidal behavior. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. Gordon Chang is in the house. Red Letter Day here at Securing America, as far as I'm concerned. One of the great leaders and commentators, analysts, and, well, savants, really, about the Chinese Communist Party, what it's up to, and what it means for all of us. And Gordon, I hated to interrupt you, but you were making a really important point. I mean, I think all of us would prefer to see those factories repatriated to the United States, but there is an opportunity to improve our position and certainly help our interests in that region of Central America if factories were to be moved there. You also were making an interesting point for those who care about climate change, not so much the Chinese Communist Party, by the way, but talk a little bit about the impact on the environment that, if you care, you are concerned about greenhouse gases are emitted by those long distance shipping vessels that we rely upon to move stuff from China here.
Yeah, people say, Frank, that 15 of the largest container vessels pour as much carbon into the air as all of the world's vehicles. Now, wow. We can reduce the carbon footprint of the products that we buy by shortening the distance between the point of manufacture and the point of consumption, especially a few railroads through Central America and up through Mexico. That would do wonders for the environment. But also, there's something else. And that is, we've got a crisis at our southern border. And it's basically not Mexicans who are crossing that border. It is Central Americans, because their societies were destabilized when factories went to China, when China joined the World Trade Organization. So we stabilized those societies with manufacturing there. We also do a lot for our southern border. You know, Vice President Harris talks about root causes of the problems there. Well, the root cause is that all this manufacturing is done in China.
It is. And Gordon, it brings me to a point that I'm going to be talking about in a moment with Bill Walton again, and that is the investment, the foreign investment, but particularly the U.S. investment that is continuing to be made in China. You and I have discussed this on a number of occasions, I think, that in the event there is a shooting war, which, as we talked about in the last block, is a distinct possibility, if not a very high probability, and possibly in the very near future, all of that money is going to be very difficult to repatriate, I think it's fair to say, if not just completely gone. And yet we see Wall Street continuing to try to put money in Alibaba. We got $25 billion the other day, I think. Talk a little bit about the importance as part of this strategy, whether it's under the IEPA, you know, powers or some other, should the president be willing to do so, to constrict the cash flow to China that will, if constricted, make it much more difficult for them to build nuclear weapons, as you talk about in your piece, or build out this colonial empire of their Belt and Road Initiative, or do any number of other things that are very dangerous for us and our interests?
China has a very bad case of imperial overstretch. I mean, they have, for instance, we know that the Chinese military is grabbing bigger and bigger shares of the resources of the budget of the central government. But also, that's not their only grand project. I mean, their surveillance state internally actually requires more resources than the Chinese military. You got the Belt and Road Initiative. You have all sorts of Chinese diplomatic initiatives about trying to corral these countries. All of this takes a lot of money, and Beijing doesn't really have as much as we think it does. And that really, and by the way, I think their foreign exchange reserves are smaller than they report, though maybe their gold reserves are bigger than they report. It's a little bit unclear. But the point is, whatever it is just morally wrong to build the weapons for your enemy who is going to use those weapons to kill Americans. It's just
morally wrong is one aspect of it. I think strategically insane.
It is strategically insane. Yes, of course. but it fails on all counts.
It does. And yet we persist in doing it. And again, one of the reasons why I'm really keen to have people take a look at this indictment is if you treat the Chinese Communist Party, as you know better than anybody, Gordon, as the transnational criminal organization it is, and you recognize that that transnational criminal organization is engaged in not only crimes against humanity on an unprecedented scale, but also war crimes against us. One of the things that is hopefully something we can drive home to people who seem to have no difficulty betraying our country is that there may be criminal penalties associated with being accomplices to this Chinese criminal behavior, and specifically the people funding it, underwriting it, enabling it with our money. So all of this is vital. And Gordon, let me just pivot to one other thing. You mentioned, I think a moment ago, this surveillance state that is a prime project of the Chinese Communist Party internal to the country. As you know, they have also been busily trying to export it elsewhere around the world. I'm not sure you're aware of this, but I wanted to call it to your attention because you are one of the great influencers in our country, and I hope you might give us a hand with it, Gordon. I'll talk a little bit about it more with Bill in a second, but we've put together something we call the Sovereignty Coalition to campaign for the removal of the United States from the World Health Organization before the Chinese Communist Party, which, as you know, essentially controls that operation, is able to close the trap that is now in the offing, thanks again to Joe Biden's efforts, to essentially surrender our sovereignty to this WHO, which made such a hash up of pandemic 1.0, and now seeks to have the power to command us to do whatever they say about whatever they call a public health emergency of international concern. So we've put together what we call the American Sovereignty Declaration at sovereigntycoalition.org, and we're encouraging people to sign up to it to help us get out of this organization before, again, everything we hold dear, not just our public health, but perhaps the very essence of our constitutional republic is endangered. And I wonder, to the extent that the WHO has as a prime project in this enterprise, making everybody have health IDs, digital health IDs, which become then the platforms for their so-called social credit system, we've got to head this off at the pass, don't you think?
Absolutely. The pandemic treaty is a threat for the reasons that you mentioned. I think that, obviously the world needs some health architecture, but the World Health Organization is, I think, very much undermines global health. We know that because in January of 2020, when coronavirus was escaping China, the WHO actually propagated China's notion that COVID-19 was not transmissible human to human. Well, right. If we had thought that it was transmissible, we would have taken precautions. But we were lulled into not taking precautions because the WHO was taking China's obviously false narrative and giving legitimization to it. So, for that reason alone, Frank, it was good for President Trump to get out of the WHO. It was wrong for Biden to put us back in. And I believe we should get out and we should not ratify the pandemic treaty, which, for the reasons you mentioned, is a threat to personal freedom and a threat to global health.
Yeah, you're so right. And unfortunately, the United States Senate last week said they weren't interested in ratifying the treaty. Maybe it's the week before now. Senator Johnson had an amendment saying we need to do just as you say. And by the way, there's not only this treaty, Gordon, but as you may know, there's a new agreement governing the existing advisory authorities of the international health regulations under which this thing is supposed to operate to make them all mandatory. So that has to be stopped too. And for all these reasons, because it's unlikely we will be able to stop them, we need to get ourselves out of this treaty. I hope people will go to sovereigntycoalition.org and participate in our efforts to do just that. Gordon, so much more to talk about, but thank you for your time today. As always, such a really important opportunity to take stock of the challenges that we're facing from the CCP. Nobody does it better than you. Thank you. Come back to us again next week, if you will. Bill Walton is up next. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Night in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and it's always a delight to be able to say we are back with Bill Walton, the star of The Bill Walton Show, a master of the universe, now recovering, I'm happy to say, in the Washington area, and doing incredibly important work on his television podcast in exploring some of the topics that we visit with him about each week, and we're always delighted to be able to do so. Bill Walton, welcome back to Securing America.
Frank, happy to see you.
Good to see you. Let's start with this topic that I touched on with Gordon a little bit. This company called Goshen, which is a big Chinese outfit that is explicitly tied to the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, it's baked into their articles of incorporation and so on. And they're going to take over 400 acres of pristine land in the heart of Michigan, with $700 million plus subsidy from the government of the state, tax dollar money, obviously. Bill, this would seem to be ill-advised on a lot of different levels. And I just wonder, is this obviously a problem in the microcosmic sense, but we're seeing stuff like this happening across America. And I just wonder what your thoughts are about the folks who are enabling it.
Well, Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, it's hard to see. It's hard. What she deserves is some sort of award for or some sort of punishment for anti-Americanism. I mean, you know, remember, she was the one who completely locked down Michigan and wanted to declare certain portions of Lowe's essential and other portions of Lowe's non-essential. Her arrogance knows no bounds. And now she's bringing a Chinese company into Michigan after the Michigan politicians and federal politicians have assiduously shipped hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Michigan jobs to China. Mm-hmm. Now they want to bring a Chinese company in. And I think, Frank, as you pointed out in one of your writings, the bylaws of the company are explicit in that it reports directly to the Chinese Communist Party. Yeah. No ifs, and or buts. It's not That's even right. It's not even
indirect control or this, you know, submission.
It's explicit.
Owned and operated. Yeah.
And as you and I have talked about, you know, what they want to do with this plant is environmentally egregious. Lithium is part of what's going to be involved there. And they're already trying to buy up property around the facility, telling people who don't want to sell, well, look, your water is going to be ruined because it's going to be laced with lithium pretty soon. Yeah. So better
lithium
sell now or you never
on your
sell.
Land. Yeah, no, that's right.
You know, they want American waters to be like Chinese waters. Chinese, of course, is the home of the most polluted inland waterways on the planet.
Yeah,
and
I couldn't agree more.
So this is
bad business.
The list goes on and on and on about why this is a bad idea.
To say nothing of the national security implications of having this operation with, they say, something on the order of 180 semi-trucks coming in and out of the property every day. What could possibly go wrong, Bill?
Well, at least they don't need to surveil it with balloons, Frank, because they already know what's going on there.
Well, they'll be, I suspect, up to great mischief. Bill, hopefully we'll be able to turn that off with the help of the people of Michigan. And I commend to our listeners once again.
Please get involved in shutting this down. This is a terrible idea.
But the terrific webinar, to give you background on it, that we did at the Present Danger China last week, and presentdangerchina.org is where you can find it. Bill, one of the other things that we talk about most weeks is the inadvisability of your former colleagues on Wall Street continuing to enable China in another way, namely by taking our money, pension funds, mutual funds, index funds, and so on, and shipping it to China. You've been following evidence that the Chinese are once again, under Xi Jinping, using anti-corruption arguments and programs to chill, shall we say, business opportunities. Set aside for the moment the distinct possibility that we're going to be in a shooting war with these guys soon, which I think means the end of repatriating any money you've got there. But what's the likelihood that this is going to go badly for Americans investing in China if there's going to be this further, you know, essentially unpredictability at the minimum? At worst, you know, real tyranny taking place at Xi's hands in the financial sector.
You know, Frank, you and I have talked, but this has been a tale of two worlds. The one world was the China before Xi. And China actually made a lot of progress in amping up its economy and bringing about entrepreneurship, and in the process created over a thousand billionaires. And a measure of Chinese attractiveness is that there's something called a unicorn, which is a venture capital company with more than a billion dollar valuation. Well, the United States has about 900. China has 350, and so. The investment in technology and entrepreneurial energy and financial skills in China has been enormous. Now Xi comes along and he thinks that this is behavior is unseemly and anti-communist. And he's mounting a crackdown on all classes of entrepreneurs. It was the real estate companies. It was the private home tutors. It was the tech companies. Now he's aimed at the financial sector. And they've got a commission here that they just started called this is a classic right out of George Orwell, the Central Commission for Discipline Inspection. And its job is to prevent hedonism and high-end lifestyles in the Chinese banking system. Ooh, and it also wants to
that.
Do, and talking about killing entrepreneurial zeal. They want to eradicate executives' wrongful pursuit of becoming financial elites. So it's fascinating how fast and widespread this movement to kill the entrepreneurial class in China has become under Xi, and he has the totalitarian mindset that he can command and control every aspect of the Chinese economy and society. And as we all know, as Friedrich Hayek reminded us, the fatal conceit, no central government can do that. So The good news is if he keeps having his way, the Chinese system is likely to collapse. Mm-hmm. The bad news is that I think he's going to move a lot faster militarily than any of us would like. Yeah. And so even though the economy is going to be melting down, it's not going to be soon enough to stop their military ambitions.
No, to the contrary, as we've talked about, Bill, most weeks, if things continue to go bad.
And my weekly warning, if you have money, don't put it in China.
Yeah, amen. But this idea that domestic turmoil isn't going to translate into external, you know, ambitions, if only to divert and justify that increased repression at home.
People are crowing about the Chinese economy is not growing. In fact, Gordon Chang, our friend, says it actually shrunk last year, and I agree with him.
Just talk with him.
But we shouldn't be crowing because a weakening adversary is a more aggressive adversary. And I think Xi's making calculations about how rapidly he needs to move before his resources start ebbing.
Yeah. Well, I think Gordon agrees with that. Bill, one other piece of this that I wanted just to touch with you on as evidence of that increasing internal control is this announcement that 16 different aspects of the government's work, central government's work, that is, are now national security sensitive topics, including politics and the ecology, for heaven's sakes. I mean, is this not a further symptom of a tyrannical regime becoming more so?
Well, we feel America's being wrecked because everything has become political. Put that on steroids and you're in China. Every single aspect of the Chinese system is political, and every single, they say 16, I don't know what the denominator is. I think it's most of the agencies of the Chinese government have been put on war footing, essentially, and to monitor politically acceptable behavior. And Xi took control in 2012, and since then he's targeted over 4 million Chinese. You know what he calls them? He calls them tigers and flies. Mm-hmm. And basically, they're people that he doesn't feel are towing the line with what he thinks they ought to be doing to promote the state and the Chinese Communist Party. Where this ends.
And that makes them enemies of the state, presumably, right?
Well, yeah.
Subject to discipline, as they say.
Yes.
Why? Tigers and flies, that's a new one. Bill, and again, to just get to the bottom line, for those of us in this country, you're talking about a China that in the aftermath, as we talked about with Gordon, in the aftermath of this latest meeting between an American politician and President Tsai of Taiwan, is now ramping up again its aggressive behavior under the guise of military exercises and so on. This looks as though it's a bad time for us not to be on a war footing, as the Chinese are going
to
do.
Well, and as you point out, I think you've got a group signing a petition on this, which I'm eager to sign. The Chinese has been assiduously developing its control and power over global international institutions like the World Health Organization. And they have a hand-picked leader and the Biden administration is promoting an executive order or a policy where we would make our pandemic responses subservient to whatever the World Health Organization decides. And what they decide goes way beyond simple health. I mean, they're talking about digital passports. They're talking about systems of social control where they can monitor your health behavior as it feeds into where you shop, what you buy, where you travel.
Make you conform. Exactly
and
right.
Make you conform. And
let
this
me,
is supported
make sure
by,
that people know where to go to do the same, Bill. And that is
BillGatesCoalition.org.
We really need your help, folks, getting this message into the Congress. Bill, we have to leave it at that. Much more to talk with you about, but come back.
Much to cover,
week.
Frank.
We love talking with you. We'll do it again next week. God bless you, my friend.
Great, thanks.
We'll be right back with more right after this. We'll be right back.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Predictably, the Chinese Communist Party has responded to Speaker Kevin McCarthy's meeting last week with Taiwan's president by conducting increasingly aggressive military drills and other preparations for a shooting war. Even as that prospect continues to grow, American friends of China continue irresponsibly and recklessly to enable the CCP to inflict harm on us in the event of conflict. A prime example is Wall Street's ongoing practice of investing our pension plans, mutual funds, etc., in communist Chinese companies, even though in the event of a conflict, every dime would surely be lost. Then there's travesties like the governor of Michigan giving an explicitly CCP corporation called Goshen $700 million in subsidies to purchase and inevitably despoil pristine land in the state's heartland without any regard for the national security risks. We need a war footing, not more, of such suicidal behavior. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest for the first time, I believe. His name is Dr. Kevin Slack. He is a professor of politics at an absolutely stupendous organization, institution. The Hillsdale College in Michigan is one of my favorite places. If you've got to send your kid to college, this is obviously where you ought to send them if you can get them in. Larry Arnn, its president, is a longtime friend and sparring partner, and I appreciate tremendously what he does and those like Kevin Slack on the faculty there, especially in light of a new book that Dr. Slack has just generated. It's entitled War on the American Republic, How Liberalism Became Despotism, a favorite topic of ours here at Securing America. And Dr. Slack, we're delighted to have you here to tell us a bit more about your history of the evolution of so-called progressivism and liberalism into something anything but. Talk us through that, if you would, quickly. Welcome.
Well, if you look at the mid-century liberals were all about reason and toleration, but something happens in the 60s where there's a young generation of radicals that is going to change the direction of what we call Marxism. And so we often call it cultural Marxism. Mm. The idea there is that the focus is not class. And so you have a young generation that's at war with the old middle class, the old industrial middle class. And they're going to appeal to different things instead of a kind of class unity or solidarity. They're going to construct what they call the proletariat. And if you read somebody like a Herbert Marcuse or a Greg Calvert from the 60s, they're saying, well, this is going to be a new proletariat, and it's going to consist of young, educated white radicals, and they're going to unify with the, quote, wretched of the earth, which are going to be single moms, minority groups, and they're going to unify against what we understand to be Americanism. And so the focus very much changes. No longer is there going to be toleration. So, you know, famously, the argument is against, quote, liberal tolerance. Why? Because liberal tolerance only allows for ideas that might subvert leftist opinions. So a Marcuse or a John Galtung are going to argue in the 60s, you should only tolerate opinions on the radical left, not those on the radical right.
Right.
And those radicals take positions at universities, and they're still the same. So you can find the same arguments about unconscious racism, systemic white supremacy, and so on in the early 70s.
Yeah, but that's one of the key points that I wanted to draw you out on is we're talking about not class warfare, but race warfare. And these leftists, these Marxists, I think that's the right term for it, have embraced it, identity, identity, politics, and all that, gender identity, I should say. But fundamentally, it's all about cultural Marxism, the divide and conquer strategy, is it not?
Yes. So if you look at somebody like an Antonio Gramsci, one of the arguments was that the institutions of a society aren't the mere superstructure, the way that Marx had described them as expressions of civil society or economic relations. Rather, these are institutions that that radicals should work their way through. And so, you know, that famous phrase, the long march through the institutions.
Exactly.
And so you divide the American public. It's also a good way to control people. Think about how the whole trans revolution is ideal for controlling people, their most private, intimate spaces. So, you know, you could argue that feminism was, and very explicitly stated so, a way to destroy the old family, right? An institution that might attract your loyalty from simply the state. When you get into the trans revolution, now you're dealing with who you're going to the bathroom besides, who you're showering with, and now the state reserves the right to be able to order you in those private spaces.
Compel you. Indeed. Yeah. And I'm sure this isn't happening at Hillsdale College, but it is happening in a lot of institutions across this country, both educational institutions and others, to the point where it is truly corrosive, not just to the family, which, as you know, is a main target of these cultural Marxists, but to the institutions, the confidence in government, the rule of law. I mean, the republic itself, as you say, this is about war on the American republic.
I think that conservatives have long failed to realize that as an alternative religion, when you move into these different metaphysical systems of race, of gender, genderism, that this is a real source of meaning for people. And so it invades Christian circles, Christian churches. It invades universities, small liberal arts colleges, even the Great Books programs. That's what we're seeing now.
Really?
Just because you have a charter classical school doesn't mean that they're not going to water down the curriculum and start introducing, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives into those curricula.
You're going to get your critical race theory classical books, I guess, taught as part of your curriculum.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's not happening at Hillsdale College, but still, I think your point is well taken that this is part and parcel of the agenda. And normalizing it, marching through the institutions has been, I suspect, successful beyond the wildest imaginations of the Gramscis and the Marcuses, don't you think?
Well, I think that was the plan. You know, it's commented on in the 1970s. You know, whether we could disagree with the 1960s liberals and the civil rights bill, but the actual wording of that bill is quite colorblind. And so, if you take over the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission or the Office of Civil Rights, then you can change the actual phrasing of the bill and have those changes approved by federal courts. And that's what happened throughout the 70s and 80s.
Yeah. And is continuing to happen as we speak. And the problem is, I think the trajectory is such that it's accelerating. And the war on America that you're describing in a book, War on the American Republic, is now perilously close, I fear, to sort of reaching a tipping point. And why I think your characterization of liberalism becoming despotism is so vital is if there is to be a corrective to it, it has to be on the basis of understanding that that's what these guys have in mind for us is full-on despotism. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back with more with Dr. Kevin Slack, the author of The War on the American Republic. And we're going to talk about the enemies foreign and the contributions they're making to the enemies within. Stay tuned for that and more on the other side of this short break. We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we are continuing a conversation with a man I've just met, and I'm delighted to introduce to you, as well as learn more about his important new work entitled War on the American Republic, How Liberalism Became Despotism. His name is Dr. Kevin Slack. He is a professor of politics at a wonderful academic institution, one of the few of which I can say that, here in the United States, Hillsdale College in Michigan. And Dr. Slack, I wanted to just ask you, cultural Marxism, of course, isn't the creation of the radical left. It's something that I would believe was invented and applied aggressively by Mao Zedong in China. And he wielded it aggressively against his own adversaries internal to China. And he is, and his successors have been busily exporting it elsewhere around the world. Talk, if you would, a little bit from your studies of what this evolution has involved about the role that the Chinese Communist Party, the Maoists, the Marxists more generally abroad have been playing in inculcating through, among other things, organizations like the United Front Work Department of the Chinese Communist Party, this cultural Marxist takedown of our country.
Well, I think that there was a recognition in the 1970s, but as you move forward, particularly the 90s and globalization, that you could adopt certain, we'd call them free market, but really monopoly capitalist measures. And it didn't have to require any political freedoms at all, any of the freedoms, the rights of citizenship that have made the United States what it is. What you find is a quote unquote partnership, right? So we've accepted Chinese students in very large numbers without any recognition that they weren't going to accept our political freedoms. Consider the outsourcing and the push to accept China into the WTO all throughout the 90s that was achieved in 2001. And even the willingness to outsource large shares of our manufacturing sector, particularly under George W. Bush. That's when this accelerated the fastest, to the point where I think there was a decline in manufacturing growth, 30%, was really remarkable. And all the time you find those in the Democratic Party, but Washington establishment types who are praising China. I don't know if you call this Thomas Friedman, this was around 2010, I believe, with the rise of the Tea Party, said in, it was the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, one or the other, probably New York Times,
I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
And he said, China works because they have a one-party system. We have the party of no in the Republican Party. And so we'd be better off if our, quote, democracy had a one-party rule. Quite remarkable comments by Bloomberg, for example, saying China's a democracy. So you have the ability to buy off the United States and its elites through various Republican Party leaders, people like Mitch McConnell, who are actually related to the Chinese Communist Party. And in doing so, being able to drive our politics. James Madison, very interestingly, I got to put this in the 1790s, he warned about economic dependence on Britain, because if we start buying their cheap manufacturers, he says, our economic dependence will lead to a political dependence. And I think we see the same thing with China today.
Yeah. No, look, they've raised it to an art form. But let me just ask you about this one other piece of it, because elite capture is clearly a driving force in the strategy they call unrestricted warfare against our country. And we talk about it endlessly on this program. But the thing that I think you're bringing to the table is that the ideological component of this is operating as well. It's not just, you know, venal buying of people. It's that some are embracing the ideology. And I'm particularly interested because, you know, you're working with young people all the time. And I suspect even among the Hillsdale, you know, student body, you have people who are on TikTok. And one of the things that is worrying to me is, yeah, they're collecting data and they're weaponizing that data and all the rest of it. That's very problematic, of course. But they're also using this as a means of mainlining into our young people certain, well, ideological predispositions, animus towards our own country and admiring of the Chinese Communist Party and its so-called People's Republic. How does that factor in to this transformation from liberalism to despotism and to the prospects for defeat in this war on the American Republic?
Well, I think that one of the most important things is preserving an education in freedom. And I think that the use of TikTok, and we've seen this with the different algorithms that control the United States and China that they've made quite a big deal about, justly so, is that they're playing to what is not freedom, but it's really a form of despotism in being able to govern people like sheep, right, by pleasure and pain. And so if you can diminish the attention spans of your enemy, if you can divide them to get them to hate their own country, then you're really destroying the education necessary to make them make sacrifices for freedom. In fact, freedom is the last thing that they really want. They're not going to want their own political freedoms. They're going to equate freedom with license, things like hedonism, pleasure, sex, drugs, those kinds of things.
But those are things that I think the Chinese are trying to encourage our young people to prioritize. Are they not? Not their own people, of course. They've got a very different model for TikTok internally. But isn't hedonism, one of the things that they want us to indulge in to the point where we're completely distracted from the danger that they've posed to us?
Definitely. And it plays into the class warfare here in the United States. If you end up with a ruling class that allies itself with those who are the most degenerate of society, look at how the major cities are run, San Francisco or Portland. You have these armies of street defecators and drug users and tent cities demanding their rights. And then on the other hand, you find the cops are shaking down taxpayers, right? They're pulling over women for speeding outside of school zones, suburban soccer moms. And so that ties into the class warfare that you're trying to gut and erode the very population, the people that would make a country strongest, people exactly. who have the older virtues of hard work, industry, frugality, self-restraint.
Yeah. And a love of freedom.
Love of
that
freedom,
is
love of
central to, of course, a constitutional republic, which, as you point out so well, is under assault of the first order. Dr. Slack, we're running out of time, but we have to have you back for an hour-long conversation about all this, if you'd indulge me. This is fascinating and vital, and thank you for this really important new book, War on the American Republic, How Liberalism Became Despotism. Congratulations. Let's talk again soon. I'll talk to the rest of you next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.